It's the Steve Fast Show on WJBC. Everybody knows what has come to be known as the Great American Songbook. Tunes written by the likes of the Gershwins, Cole Porter, and Irving Berlin that were big hits in their day and then have been revisited from everyone from Frank Sinatra to Lady Gaga. Some people might say they don't write them like that anymore, but is there a reason for that? In his new book, The B-Side, cultural critic Ben Yagoda writes about the time when popular music changed from a jazz-based style to one of country rock and sometimes just pure novelty. And we welcome Ben Yagoda to the program. Ben, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
The assertion for many is that rock and roll pushed out the Great American Songbook style of popular music. But you say that the types of standards that, say, Sinatra would sing were already on the way out before teenage rock and roll took over the airwaves.
That's right. If you look at trade papers like Billboard and Variety and so forth, even as early as about 1947, 1948, people like Sinatra, who you just mentioned, were bemoaning the fact that there aren't any good songs being written. Everything's a junky song or a novelty number. And this idea persisted on through the early 50s and was really well established by the time rock and roll hit in 55 or 56.
A lot of pop music doesn't stand the test of time. So in retrospect, there's a tendency to forget some of the less substantial stuff that was in the mainstream. So what were the kind of songs that were really popular in that transition between sort of the jazzier songs before rock and roll really took over in the late 50s?
You make a great point. I think it was the science fiction writer Theodore Sturgeon, who's quoted as making Sturgeon's rule, which is 90% of anything is junk, only a stronger word than junk that I don't think I can say on the radio. So even in the so-called golden era of the Great American Songbook, which is basically kind of the mid-20s through the late 40s, when Gershwin and Jerome Kern and Harold Arlen and Cole Porter were doing their best stuff. Even then, I mean, the biggest hit of the 1920s, or at least one of them, was Yes, We Have No Bananas, which is, you know that song, I assume.
I will say it has had lasting power.
It has lasting power. It's the most inane thing. But yeah, it's a novelty number. And sure, all through that time, there were other big hits that were equally inane or mushy, silly songs like Maisie Doats and so forth. But I guess the difference, and you can see it in retrospect, is that in that period there was great songs, standard songs, middle-of-the-road songs, and these sort of silly songs. In that late 40s, early 50s period, the pendulum shifted so that there were more of the less lasting songs. The biggest hit in 1953 was How Much Is That Doggy in the Window? There were all these kind of pseudo-fake ethnic songs like Mambo Italiano and Come On to My House. Interestingly, also, though, folk music, which really hadn't been noteworthy in the sort of pre-World War II era, came forward. And so Pete Seeger and the Uyghurs had a number one hit in the early 50s with Lead Belly's Goodnight Irene, this folk song written by an African-American ex-convict. So there was all sorts of stuff going on. There was just less of this material that we think of as the standards, the Great American Songbook, the kind of things that Tony Bennett, still does in his concerts and Sinatra did. That kind of fell by the wayside, and all this other material rose to the surface.
Well, at the height of when those composers like Cole Porter and the Gershwins were writing in their contemporary time, music publishers of the day had sort of a monopoly. And the challenge to that monopoly may have led to a widening of the net of whose songs would get published and get pushed.
Right. You know, what the word monopoly brings to my mind is the organization known as ASCAP, the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers. So this was the rights organization that the songwriters and, as you say, the music publishers. Back in those early days, especially in the teens and 20s, sheet music was paramount. That was the music delivery system. Every middle class or above family had a piano, and someone who could play or at least pick at the piano, and people would buy the hit songs of the day in sheet music form, and hence publishers got a lot of power. That changed with the advent of phonograph records and radio, but still publishers reaped a benefit from when songs were played on the radio. ASCAP collected money for every song that was played on radio stations through the 20s and 30s, and the money was split between the writers and the publishers. And they pretty much had a monopoly on music. And as monopolists will do, they kept on raising and raising and raising the rates that they demanded from the radio stations. Until finally, the radio networks, the two or three major networks in those days, got together and said, this really isn't working for us. We are going to wean ourselves from ASCAP material. And so they banned ASCAP songs from the airwaves in 1941. Instead, there were folk songs, songs in the public domain. Stephen Foster's Jeannie with the Light Brown Hair was played so often that one commentator said her hair turned gray. And then finally, they started their own song rights organization to compete with ASCAP called BMI. And they signed up all these writers like Leadbelly, Hank Williams, Gene Autry, people who would never able to have gotten into ASCAP, African Americans, what would later be called country music. And all of a sudden, that stuff got on the air. The ASCAP band ended after about a year, 1942, after which the songs coexisted, but the genie had been left out of the bottle. And, you know, people like the young Elvis Presley and Chuck Berry and all the early rock and rollers, that was the stuff they started to listen to when they were kids in the 40s and inspired them to create rock and roll.
We're talking with Ben Yagoda, his new book, The B-Side, The Death of Tin Pan Alley and the Rebirth of the Great American Song, talks about how the classic Great American Songbook jazz influenced era of popular music gave way to something else after World War II and before rock and roll. So at this pivotal moment in history, there was a guy that many people might not realize was a driving force for the music industry, and that was Mitch Miller. A lot of people might remember him from his TV show, or more than likely have seen one of the zillions of albums that he sold as they now exist in these used record bins at the Goodwill store. But he was more than just this Lawrence Welk kind of figure. He was a major player at Columbia Records.
He was, and as you say, before I started the book, you know, I was born in the mid-50s, and when I was a little boy, had a vague sense of this goateed figure. Mitch Miller's nickname was The Beard because of his trademark goatee, leading these, you know, all-male choruses and later brought in women like Leslie Uggams. Yeah, sing along with Mitch. And actually, Mitch Miller died at the age of 99 just as I was starting work on the book. And reading his obituaries, I began to realize what you say, how powerful he was, and also what a contentious figure he was. He became the head of popular music at Columbia Records in 1950, and Columbia was the biggest record label in the country, so he was the most powerful man in popular music. Before that, he was a major figure in classical music. He was a oboe prodigy and was a very successful oboist in his younger days, but he switched over to record production, got into popular music, and, you know, a lot of these novelty numbers that we spoke about, that was kind of his sweet spot. He emphasized the record over the song. He was the first record producer in the way we think of that now. So he was in the control room, and he put in special effects. One of his first big hits was Mule Train by Frankie Lane in the late 40s, and he put in the sound of a whip, which wasn't really a whip, it was two wooden blocks clacking together. But this was kind of a revelation. No one thought of that at the time. And so he put in production values, harpsichords and French horns and overdubbing a singer as the kind of thing Les Paul was doing at another label. But music purists, even popular music purists, this was derided as gimmicks and just sort of fluff, and that Mitch Miller didn't care about music in itself. And in a way, that was true. I mean, he was quoted as saying that to him, the only real good music was classical music, and basically everything else was just a commodity. And that was the way he approached it. And when he came on to Columbia, Sinatra was a singer at the label, and he was like in the low point of his career. And he and Miller famously clashed. Miller gave him novelty material to record, like a song called Mama Will Bark, which is a duet with Dagmar, which featured the sound of barking dogs. And ever after, Sinatra left the label a couple of years later to go to Capitol, but he always blamed Miller for his declining fortunes. And they conducted for about 3.5 decades this feud that only ended when Sinatra died.
Around this time, big bands were also falling out of favor after World War II. And jazz was also becoming more interesting and complex. So as these novelty songs, where maybe the performance wasn't necessarily the key thing, or the documentation of a band performing wasn't as vital as it used to be, because, as you say, there was overdubbing, there was a reliance on gimmicks and special effects. Did the changing approach towards live performance of jazz for records nudge what was happening in jazz with the birth of things like bebop and jazz actually leaving the mainstream for the most talented people that were playing it?
Right. I do think that jazz was a really big part of the story. In that earlier period, up through the war, the so-called swing era of the big bands and also small groups, people like Lester Young and singers like Billie Holiday. This was a time when the best popular music was influenced by jazz, and then jazz musicians took these songs and performed them, and there was a great integration going on. Just both sides, the songwriting and the jazz performance, gained from each other. And it was a really, in retrospect, wonderful, exciting time. After the war, for a number of reasons, that fell apart. As you mentioned, these bebop jazz musicians, Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, big band leaders like Stan Kenton, were interested in expanding the form and understandably doing more what they thought of as artistic and creative things. The things they did, though, led, as I think you said, jazz away from the mainstream. It became more almost like a classical high art form instead of a popular art form. It didn't really depend on songs so much as improvisation. And the other really key thing about it was, in that big band era of swing, I mentioned the songwriting and the performance. The third element was dance. People went out and danced to this stuff, and that was where part of, you know, where the beat came in. And all of it fed on each other. After the war, people came home from the war, servicemen, and they had the young families to raise. They didn't really feel like going out dancing. They wanted to stay home and listen to the radio or watch television and have, you know, comforting sing-along with Mitch kind of material. So I think that was a key part of the story, that the integration of jazz and popular music splintered after the war.
Well, and also after the war, but before Elvis and Bill Haley and the Comets and the rock and roll onslaught, you had people that sort of had their feet in both worlds. Patti Page, Dinah Shore, even Nat King Cole. These are people that could be seen as jazz artists, standard singers, but also then would be doing some of these novelty songs and even country and western influenced songs.
Yeah. As the big bands broke up, just a remarkable number of the boy and so-called boy and girl singers who were part of the bands. And in the big band era, they were very marginal figures. They would kind of sit by the side of the stage as the band went through a couple of choruses. Then they would come up to the microphone for one and then sit back down again. The only really major singers were Sinatra and Bing Crosby. And Sinatra himself was the one who led the way, leaving the bands, Dorsey in his case, and going out on their own. So people you mentioned, like Dinah Shore, Doris Day, Perry Como, on and on and on, they became stars after the war. And, you know, the material they were either given or chose tended to be a little bit in the novelty number, but more on the sentimental ballads. A lot of these things that are just completely not remembered now that the audiences seem to want. You know, the slow, slow pieces with strings and heartfelt sentiments. In my view, you know, not very good stuff. I like sentiment as much as the next guy, but the sentiment in this material, in this period, was not really high-grade sentiment. But that was what the public wanted.
Ben Yagoda's book about the death of Tin Pan Alley and the rebirth of the great American song is called The B-Side. Ben, thanks so much for joining us today to talk about this.
Hey, thank you so much. It's my pleasure. I appreciate you having me.